You were at the Penn International Congress, weren't you, a year ago, a year and a half ago, weren't you?
Wasn't it longer ago?
2 years, was it?
Seems like forever. But I was. I gave one of the keynote addresses.
I tried to talk to you there, and I approached you, and I said, I'd like to ask you a couple of questions, and you looked at me with such shock, as if, why would he want to talk to me? I mean, why? I don't have a book out right now. And that was kind of an interesting function in a way. It just seemed to get a little out of control, some of the issues.
Oh, they tried to do
so non-related to writing.
Well, they weren't. They were non-related to writing, but they were very much concerned with writers. But I think they just tried to cram everything down everybody's throats because there was such hunger for some kind of coalition. So, I mean, people were desperate. They had no idea that many people were interested in the Congress. You know, you remember how it was. They had a meeting arrangement for 1,700 people and 5,000 people showed up and more, and they had to go into 2 or 3 hotels.
Yeah, those two, the major hotels they were located in, weren't really adequate.
No.
You know, I remember going up to the session on censorship, which was at the St. Regis? Which one was it? I can't remember which one it was. It was the older of the two. Mm-hmm. And I think they have 3 elevators to service that whole building, like 33 stories, you know. And it was a 30-minute wait for an elevator to get up to the top.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, but it was still, for me, just a marvelous experience to be around so much writing talent in one place. I mean, it was, I think that alone was
Are you talking about the one where Norman Mailer?
No.
Oh, I'm thinking about something quite different, which was longer ago, which also was sponsored by Penn, which was literally called a Congress out of which they wanted to make unions. Mm-hmm. But I know, it was a year and a half ago. And it was similar to the earlier one. Lots of controversy, but on a more international scale.
It was so
the
silly.
Americans felt very defensive.
It was so silly. I mean, looking back at it now, after all the months that have gone by, I think the key issue was whether or not George Shultz should have been invited.
That's true. They concentrated on that.
And he could have been invited and spoken and ignored.
And then about whether women were represented. That was a big issue.
I think they were struggling for issues. I mean, something to sink your teeth into.
That turned out to be a real issue. I mean, a violent issue, because it provoked a lot of speeches by all sorts of people, and a real task force came out of that, which exists now. And then, it seemed to me the principal sort of conflict came when the Europeans began to complain about the passivity and the indifference to social questions of the Americans, who got very annoyed with that assumption, and there were all sorts of caucuses about that. That was interesting.
Oh, it was funny to see old Gunter Grass get up there. I mean, he would line up with his pipe waiting to speak. He was like an old crocodile waiting to pounce. It was fun. That was a very interesting occasion. I had company had allowed me an entire week off of my other duties to cover it. So
to go around that whole operation.
Yeah, I was there for a whole week.
Yes.
I was so busy covering it that I couldn't even go to any of the parties. But we really want to talk about you, and we want to talk about Beloved. When I was reading Beloved, I did what I usually try to do, and that is to read in large hunks and read as fast as I can. And I got well into it, and I said, hey, wait a minute, what's going on here? I've got to start over again. And I had read about maybe 20% of the book, and I went back. I was having difficulty understanding it. I said, what's happening here? I mean, who is Beloved? I mean, where did she come from? And what is this all about? So I went back. It was there. It was kind of an interesting quote that not Stanley Elkin, but his colleague at Washington University, whose name escapes me, but I'll think of it.
Gass?
What?
Bill Gass?
William Gass, yes. He said, you can't rush a book. He said, you can't rush a novel because it's like trying to rush Mozart.
Oh, that's lovely.
Which was kind of nice. Because books do have their own rhythms. And some books you can rush. You can look, some books spell everything out for you. And so you can look at key words. Nonfiction is particularly good at that. You know, that's
skim.
Why. What's that?
You can skim.
Yeah, you can skip, and you can skim, and you can, but you can take it in fast. Murder mysteries, if they're not very well written, are easy to read, fast to read, because all of the keywords are there for you. All the descriptions are there, and they don't make you think. Well, of course, Beloved is just the opposite. So I found myself going back and slowing down and reading and taking my time and savoring it. There were many portions that read like poetry. But in my initial confusion, of course, I began to understand what was going on. I did have some difficulty, and I have it now, with regard to Beloved. I didn't know whether Beloved was a ghost or whether it was an hallucination. But I'm not sure that the writer is supposed to spell all of that out. I assume that so many people saw Beloved that she was a ghost. So how many, that many people couldn't hallucinate? So tell me a little bit about how you developed this character of Beloved and what you were trying to do with it.
Well, initially, she was a way of representing history or the past or memory. But rather in an abstract way, I wanted it to become flesh. So that we all have problems with controlling and redirecting the past, individual pasts, what we select to remember out of it and what we decide to refuse to remember. In her situation, in the heroine situation, the mother, Setha, her act was unacceptable and outrageous, and so she was haunted by it. Something, the only person who could ask her the real questions and the only person she wanted to explain her activity to would be the child that she had tried to kill and had succeeded in killing. So I wanted the possibility of this girl, daughter, grown up, coming back into the house to pose the important questions of the perfect dilemma. Now, at the fact that she... the fact that everybody in the book believes she's a ghost is deliberate, of course, because they do. I don't necessarily want or encourage or require that the reader believe that she is a ghost, and there's lots of evidence in the book that she is a person. But in any case, they desire her to be the dead daughter. Denver does, and Setha does, her erstwhile sister and erstwhile mother, and there's something in that house that that girl needs. So the combination of all their needs and desires for this other person who completes them is what is important.
Well, you called it an outrageous act for the mother to take the life of the daughter, and yet it seems to me there might be some justification for it. The mother so frightened that this child might be taken back into slavery and to ordeal she had. Is this not a justification?
It's the one horn of the dilemma, which is to say what she did was inevitable and in a sense right. But the problem, of course, is that she had no right to do it. But she is in a situation in which the one of the things that she certainly is not is a mother. She's not that. Slavery doesn't permit that. Slavery says you have no control over your children. Slavery says your children do not belong to you. Slavery says you go over there and sleep with that man and produce a child. And this one, and this one, and this one. So that she's denied that. So her ferocity in insisting that she is a mother, she has to take the consequences of that. And she decided that she was. She claimed the life of those children. What we may take for granted in advising our children, watching them grow, etc., and having something to do with their future, all of those things were denied her. So she simply reappropriated it, took it. And in that line, and knowing what she knew about how unlivable the life was for her, she was saying, well, perhaps me, but not my children. And history's full of such incidents where people do extraordinary things to protect the clean, the unsullied, the innocent children. So she said that, and slavery said, you have nothing to do with it. Now, anything she had done in that situation is unthinkable. If she had said, oh, all right, we'll go back, it's unthinkable for her. All of what they had gone through, being there, and to get out and to simply permit it to happen again to the best thing, as she calls herself, she was. That's unthinkable. So her solution was to remove them all from having to make that choice and to kill them all. That is also unthinkable. So we ask the question, as you have done, wasn't it justified? Well, I can't answer that question, but I know some, I can't even ask it. But the person who can ask it is the dead child. That's the one who has to say, wait a minute, are you sure this was for my welfare?
Well, I hope we haven't given away too much. All of these details develop as the book goes on. Beloved is your fifth novel, is that correct?
Yes, yes.
And it is the first historical novel.
It is, actually, yes. Unusual for me.
Why did you decide to break with the contemporary themes and do something about slavery in the post-Civil War era?
I thought of it really as doing something contemporary, really, because I thought I was involved in the tracking of a contemporary theme, which was the complicated problems women have these days and have had for a long time in trying to juggle the requirements of nurturing, mothering, taking care of, and becoming separate, complete individuals. And why is that a conflict? And is it, and what are the circumstances? So in order to track it all the way to 1986, I began with this story, which was for me classically designed to introduce the idea of nurturing and what sacrifices women have made to do it. And the second part would do another look at that under different circumstances.
So Beloved is the beginning of a cycle.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, I still am involved at this moment in doing another part. And but one doesn't always know.
With the same characters?
Perhaps.
Certainly. Like Denver in a maturing role and this sort of thing?
Perhaps.
Well, you can't give away too much. That would probably be fair. Well, as you began writing this book, of course, there are so many episodes of violence and torture in Beloved. Did you become as angry as I think the reader becomes as you wrote it? Or is it possible for you to have written dispassionately about this subject?
Absolutely. I couldn't write it in anger. It's not. It's
you could not write it in anger?
Mm-mm. I mean, it's a paralyzing emotion, fructifying. You can't get anything done. It's, people sort of think it's an interesting, passionate, igniting feeling. I don't think it's any of that. It's helpless.
No, I'm sorry, it's what?
Helpless. It's absence of control. And I need all of my skills, all of the control, all of my powers, and I need clarity in order to write. And anger doesn't provide any of that. I have no use for it whatsoever. I can feel melancholy, and I can feel full of regret. But anger is something that's useful to the people who watch it. It's not useful to me.
Well, in a way, you've taken adopted a professional attitude, a policeman finds himself immune from some of the things around him, I would assume. He sees so much violence sometimes, or a journalist will often report on horrible tragedies and yet remain aloof from it.
No, not that.
Well, because to become angry and professionally, personally involved would curb his ability to do the job as a professional.
That's true. But I'm not aloof and unfeeling. I am an artist, and that's putting all those things into a different cauldron. My compassion can be just as harmful. My love and my fervor can be just as harmful than writing a novel. You need some other things. You need intelligence, and you need to look. You need a gaze, a wide gaze, penetrating and roving. That's what's useful for art. It isn't, that other stuff isn't. And I don't think painters and musicians and sculptors either can use, you're moved, but you want to translate that feeling, the emotion must, what you want is the other person to have it. And you can't do that if you're just out of control yourself, or I can't, you know. And for me, art is the restoration of order. And it may discuss all sorts of terrible things, but there must be satisfaction at the end. A little bit of hunger, but also satisfaction.
What level of research did you do for Beloved? You had to know something about the lay of the land around Cincinnati, for example.
Yeah, I did a lot, and I had help, a research assistant who did a lot for me because, you know, I love to sit around in libraries, and if I had done it myself, it would have taken me 5 years longer. But this person helped me. I would write questions, and they would bring back answers of very specific details. What are the floor plans of a slaughterhouse, and what about the river community, and what were the streets of Cincinnati like in 1855 and 1873? What do things call? I mean, all of the details of the world, so that I can locate it and ground it, so to speak, in factual information. So that took a lot of research.
Now, you've been an editor at Random House for some years, haven't you? How do you reconcile your role as a writer with being an editor? Do you also need, as a writer, an editor?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Every writer does, although many think they don't. Editing, which I did for, I don't know, over 17 years, I only recently stopped, never seemed to me to be antagonistic to writing because I didn't have any vested interest in it, and I was also putting something together, you know, trying to build something when I worked with other writers as well as when I did my own writing. The profession that used to bother me when doing it at the same time was teaching. There are a lot of writers who can teach and write at the same time, and they do it terrifically. I don't seem to be able to do it because teaching is a kind of, it's an analytical process in analysis. You're taking something apart to see what it's made of, and that somehow works against the process of writing for me, in which I am putting something together, so that I found less difficulty editing and writing than I couldn't imagine teaching and writing at the same time.
Well, what you're doing has run counter, in effect, to what Gordon Lish, also over at Knopf, used to say. He said, if you want to write, you shouldn't go into publishing. You should do anything other than publishing. And, of course, he's also published a couple of books, so
yeah.
I don't know that he actually believes that. Judith Rossner does. She found herself in low jobs in publishing, secretarial work, and as she demands became greater on her, she
said, get out.
Well, she would take a lesser job.
Sure. Something that I told some writers last night, the best job to have, I think, is one that doesn't require anything. It should be, you know, something boring, something that doesn't take up your imaginative life, something that is nothing, so that the real, you know, interior life of your art can flourish. But if you have a interesting, thrilling, imaginative job, it may take away the part of you that you need to write. But in fact, everybody puts together the pieces that they need for their creative life in different ways. Some people find other people's chaos very inspirational, and if they don't have it, they'll create it. Other people need tranquility, and other people need sandwiches. You never know, but that's what I learned as an editor, is that when you edit somebody, the first thing you have to find out is, what do you need? What do you need to make it work for you? Do you need money? Do you need anger? Do you need, what is it? And let me see if I can reproduce that situation, or at least give you the comfort and succor that you need in order to do the best work you can do. And I have found that it wavers from one end of the spectrum to another. People need all sorts of things, because you have to tell yourself strange things that you sort of know are not true, you know, illusions, in order to do that kind of work. It's hard and it's special.
Did you leave the editing job to focus on your writing full time?
That's what I said, yes, that I wanted to see if I could live without having two or three jobs. except I couldn't do it after my fourth novel.
Everybody wants that. Most people can't do it, but I mean, everybody
I
dreams about doing that. Let me ask you a couple of questions about yourself. I have biographical notes that Knopf sent over. You were born in Lorain, Ohio. What was that like?
Lorain, Ohio?
Yeah.
It's a working class town on Lake Erie. Undistinguished, I think, as most Midwest towns are, but I think the absence of theater and, I mean, theatrical scenery and imposing buildings might be conducive to a fecund imagination. Some people live in wonderful places and that's all they do. They are overwhelmed by the glamour and the marvelousness of the geography of the location. But what I remember was the intimacy in Lorain, Ohio, small, 30,000 people, and being on the lake, and the and during the Depression, and most of us.
It does not sound like a bookish or literary town at all.
No, it wasn't. They didn't even have a bookstore. They had what bookstores used to be, which was a sort of shady place. And the bookstore business didn't start at the Harvard Coop. I mean, the commercial bookstore business was usually a place where you shot pool and had a few books in the window. But they had one of those. But they didn't have, and they had one library.
Where what did your family do?
For a living?
Mm-hmm.
My father worked in the mills there.
In the mill?
Steel mill.
Was there any kind of literary orientation as you grew up that would give you some inkling that someday you would become an editor and a writer?
No, I was a reader. We were all that because, you know, this is pre-television days, so there was only radio, each other, and there were books. And they set great store by that. And I don't even remember my life before I could read. But I never thought about being a writer. I was quite content to be a reader. And as a matter of fact, I think that was the impulse for the first book I wrote, which is to say, I was less interested at the time in writing it as I was hoping to get through it so I could read it when I got finished.
You went on to Howard University in Washington, huh?
Mm-hmm.
What did you study there?
English and dramatic literature.
So by that time you had some idea about what you envisioned for your future.
Oh, never had any. I had no good counseling. I was sort of, first of all, I was not sure that I would ever complete the school. My mother and father could not afford to send me to college, so they promised that they could get together enough money for me to go 1 year. And I was happy about that. I didn't know I would be able to afford a second year. It was very ad hoc. So I minored in classics, as I had done in high school, and I majored in English. Then suddenly it was over, and there I was, graduated. So I went to some more schools, since that's what I did well, and there were no jobs, really. I mean, I had done all that. I worked a job since I was 12 years old. And all the jobs available to me I'd already completed. I mean, I couldn't get a job at AT&T. And I, you know, couldn't get a job at Woolworths either. So if the phone company's not going to hire you and the 10-cent store's not going to hire you, there are very few options left over. And there were two. One was to be a teacher. And so I went and got a graduate degree, and that's what I did.
I bet you when you go back to Howard University today, they give you all sorts of honorary degrees. And,
very nice.
You're probably one of the key alumnus at Howard today, I would guess.
I think so.
You'd like royalty when you go there. Well, tell me about your first book, how that came about. Were you at that time teaching when you wrote it?
No, I had left teaching and I was now in publishing.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, before we talk about the book, then, how did you get into the publishing area? What was the transition like?
I answered an ad in the New York Review of Books, which was an ad for an editor, textbook editor. And I had written a textbook when I was a teacher. And so I answered the ad and they sent me a telegram. So I went. And it turned out that was a textbook industry that Random House had just bought and was moving into Random House, New York. So I worked there for 5 years before I went into trade. And it was there, in Syracuse, where that part of the company was, that I began to spend evenings writing this story. But I was not a young girl at that time. I had two children. I was 30. So it was something I was doing for myself. And I was in publishing, and I had no awe I mean, I was not just champing at the bit to be published. And it happened after a friend of mine suggested I send that manuscript to his editor. And I, you know, really, it sounds strange after all this time, but that's not, that was nothing, to publish was not the impulse to write then. What happened after I wrote that first book was that I didn't want to not write. I mean, I liked it. I liked doing it, thinking about it. I liked how difficult it was. And I liked setting certain kinds of obstacles for myself. So I continued. And, you know, it's the best place for me.
So I would assume that once the bug hit you, although you were establishing yourself pretty well in publishing, and indeed eventually moved to Manhattan, you were still, it was still a means to an end.
Mm-hmm.
Publishing means to an end.
Yeah, it was work I respected, and it was always a problem getting jobs that you really didn't, that you respected. It was just hard. Most of the jobs that were available, you had to do things that were demeaning or dishonest. I mean, even, I don't mean wicked, but just, you know, awful jobs. And when I got to the point where I couldn't do it because it was not helpful, you know, I wasn't doing it well enough, I was happy that I was able to work so long in publishing because, irrespective of some of the difficulties with selling and marketing, I did the kind of work that I respect, which is work on manuscripts with gifted people. And that was good.
Well, editors are an unknown quantity in publishing. They never get a credit. You never know what the editor's role is in the book. I've heard stories about editors salvaging books and practically rewriting them. Tell me about some of the books that you worked on in your role. What were you looking for as an editor in the trade division? And what did you have, what did you ultimately come up with?
Well, I didn't want... I wasn't terribly successful in company terms. But I was very successful on my own terms because I was very much interested in finding a certain kind of new writer. I didn't want to run around stealing other authors and making deals, and, you know, that's terribly boring. But I did want to find writers who, other than me, I mean, outside of my interest, may not get published. And I also wanted to work on books by people who may not be writers, but who had a story that was important to tell. And I thought it was important for Angela Davis. I thought it was important for Muhammad Ali. I also worked on books, nonfiction books. I also did books by women. The woman who was the president of the National Organization of Women wrote a book called Sexist Justice about Women in the Legal Society. I did a book on medical care. I always wanted to do books that in some way really enlightened, whether it was nonfiction or really was first-rate fiction. So I ran the gamut, but agents did not have the kind of book I was interested in publishing, so I didn't have to go that route. I mean, it would have been easier for me to work that way and more acceptable for me to work that way, but I wasn't interested in working that way.
But you were lucky, too, in that Random House is big enough and courageous enough that it doesn't always look for blockbusters. I don't know, but it certainly has its share.
No,
sometimes
you're right.
More than its share. But
I was in the best place.
Yeah, it gave you a chance to develop unknowns and to look for literary books.
Mm-hmm.
So that was... Do you miss it?
I don't miss it anymore.
How long has it been since you...
3 years.
3 years. So tell me about your current life and how it's structured. I understand that you live along the Hudson River.
Uh-huh.
Tell me about that.
Beautiful.
Cold?
Yes. It's cold and it's hot. It's theatrical. There's no such thing as bad weather anymore. It's sort of like living on Lake Erie in a way. It's in a tiny little town in a funny little house on the side of the road. And I love that place. The light alone is worth it, just the way the light shines in the morning and in the afternoon. So it's ideal for me.
You have a little writing niche, I would assume, huh?
No, I think I have bad habits about that. I always wanted a writing niche, and I even made one, but I write all over the house, I mean, in the kitchen, in the bedroom.
Not the long yellow legal pads.
Yes, 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 I'm sorry.
Well, Beloved is certainly a beautiful book, Toni Morrison, and it gives us a lot to think about a particularly unfortunate period in a man's existence. And I think that the nice thing, the good thing about writers is that they can call attention to these things to us in ways that the historian can't, really. I mean,
and shouldn't, yes.
I don't think most people are going to go out and buy a history and sit down and read it with the same kind of drive and relish that they would read a novel like Beloved. I mean, they would do it if they have to do a term mm-hmm. paper.
Yeah, exactly.
So, although I'm reluctant to call you a historical novelist, because you're not, but it's a way of making things in our past alive.
Exactly.
To us. And you have indicated that with your research, I would assume most of it is accurate. So it's a wonderful book, and I'm glad that while we didn't get together at the Penn International Congress, we were able to do it now on the occasion of Beloved, and I hope we'll be able to talk again.
Thank you.
Thank you.